Thank you for joining us for episode 41 of North Star's Private Equity Fast Pitch. Our host, Jeff Henningsen, president of Lochton Companies of Houston, will be speaking with David Namkung, a co-founder and partner of operations at Kinsey Capital Partners, where he leads technology implementations and is responsible for assisting in the execution of value creation initiatives for Kinsey's portfolio companies. In addition, he oversees Kinsey's internal technology initiatives and supports various operational matters. Today, they'll be talking about David's background as a professional blackjack player and how that has impacted his career in private equity. And now, your host, Jeff Henningsen.
Bringing Down the House, 21, Johnny Magic and the Card Shark Kids. These are the books and movies that made legends of mathematicians and geeks that had the ability to see things that others couldn't see and track cards and make millions of dollars in Vegas and Atlantic City. Today I have a special treat to share with you. We're having as a guest David Namkung from Kinsey Capital. David was one of the founding partners of one of the largest professional blackjack teams in the late 90s when card counting and shuffle tracking was in vogue and as a college student or a former college student could go to Vegas and make a lot of money. He parlayed that ability to see things that others can't see into a technology consulting firm that has added significant value to many companies that they have worked with. And now he's a partner at Kinsey Capital, adding value to the companies that they invest in, seeing the things that most people don't even recognize in creating enterprise value for Kinsey and their investors. I'm really looking forward to having this discussion with David, and I think you will enjoy the conversation. So David, let's talk a little bit about your firm and yourself, and then we'll get into blackjack in a little bit.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me on your podcast. I've listened to a few of the other ones, and it's an amazing group of people you've compiled, so I'm just honored to be added to that list. By introduction, David Namkung. I'm a partner and co-founder at Kinsey Capital Partners here in Chicago. We are a lower mid-market buyout firm that looks in the consumer manufacturing services industries. What makes us a little bit different than many of the other private equity firms in our space is that we look closely through the lens of technology, having a background in technology. About 15 years ago, I started a firm called Clarity Partners, and it's about a 150-person management technology consulting firm here in Chicago. And so when we look at investment opportunities, not only do we look at firms that other private equity firms will look at, but we look through the lens of, can we implement and leverage technology to make this firm operate better? And many private equity firms look at operations as a focal point or strength of theirs. If you would imagine, look at operations and look at how technology can assist in making those operations even better. That's in many ways part of what the Kinsey investment thesis is all about. And interestingly, as we've kind of gone down this path, I'm actually quite surprised at how underlevered lower mid-market firms are in technology, to the point where at our investor meeting recently, I had a slide up that indicated how many management meetings we've had. And at that point, I had yet to meet anyone on anybody's management team that had the title of chief information officer, not a single person, which to me highlights that at this size, people understand it's an important element, but they're not incorporating into their management teams the right individuals and the right talent with that skill set, background, and experience, which just reinforces that if we can bring that to the table as a private equity investor, not only do we differentiate ourselves in the seller's mind, but we also believe that we will have outsized returns post-close by being able to implement, leverage, and take advantage of what we know as it relates to technology.
You know, it's interesting. I was having a discussion with somebody earlier today about cyber risks and how everybody is reading the headlines and even in their portfolios experiencing cyber issues, and yet people are still way behind the curve. What's your thoughts in that arena?
I agree. Cyber risk is huge. It can effectively put companies out of business or put them in situations where they're crippled or can't function for large periods of time, as well as this tremendous reputational risk. If you're attacked and, you know, there's a situation where it gets out into the marketplace, it, like anything else, you know, you lose credibility, whether you're a technology company or not, or whether technology is even a large component of your company, your brand takes a hit because you were attacked and succumbed to it or didn't have the right security measures in place. Interestingly, you know, security and cybersecurity and doing all the things from a technology standpoint around not being a victim are important. But the weakest link in that whole chain still is your people. And ironically, that's an area that companies don't spend enough time, I think, focusing on, is the training and really making sure that you go through enough exercises with your people, because people are still the greatest risk. You know, they're the ones that are falling prey to phishing schemes and some of these other things. On the actual hardware and software technology side, there are big companies that are in the business of making sure that their devices can't get hacked and such, but the people are probably the weakest point. And that's an area of focus that we think about and we look at, and we would move forward on making sure that close that gap as well.
That's an interesting point. I know that a lot of buyers are starting to do analysis of not only IT infrastructure, but they're doing test phishing schemes. What types of things are you doing or are you suggesting for your peers in the marketplace as they look at making acquisitions?
And I think those are definitely some of the things that are appropriate to look at. And but it's also like an ongoing process. You can put in place a strategy around test phishing and training and all that, but effectively, that it's almost like corporate governance. It's not a one-time exercise. You know, you need to maintain that throughout perpetuity, and you need to do it regularly enough. And you know, the newest employee that comes in that hasn't gone through that training, that's an exposure point until they're able to go through that training. So it's really a mindset that you have to have around it, and that you have to constantly be challenging and checking and preparing. And so those are the things that we would look at to make sure that we felt comfortable that our portfolio companies are prepared in that area. You know, again, on the technology side, that's a living entity all the time. So when you have a router or you have a switch, technology is constantly monitoring and checking. But when you hire a new person, is your HR department making sure that they've gone through the right anti-phishing and cybersecurity training? No other private equity firm that's looking at this size has a partner level expert in the area of technology. I've actually found it kind of fascinating how it's been received in the marketplace. Literally everyone we speak to, whether it's a potential investor or it's a seller, the thesis resonates so clearly with them to the point where everyone kind of looks around and says, really, it's not something that's been in the marketplace or established in the marketplace, which caught me off guard a little bit, because being a technologist, I think about this every day when I run my own business and how can I make sure I'm leveraging the right technologies to yield the best outcome. But when I sit down with a seller who may be a little bit older in the 60s or 70s and ask them, you know, do you feel like you made the right technology investment? Most of them kind of look at me like, no, but they didn't have any better answer and they didn't have the right advice or the right skill sets representing them on their side. And usually I say, okay, if you made this investment or an investment 5 years ago, do you think your business would be more valuable today? And they all, like, universally, everyone kind of nods their head. So as a private equity investor looking at this, my view is, okay, great. Well, let's let that new 5-year clock start today. And let's make sure that we make the right investments. And 5 years from now, our business will be more valuable than it would be without this. It's obvious, but it's not as easy to execute as it may seem. You have to have alignment of skills and priorities as well as motivations and so on and so forth. So unlike hiring consultants who their motivations and priorities may be different than if you're an equity investor in an entity. So it's probably explains why this hasn't come to fruition sooner or more frequently. However, it does surprise me still.
So I think you're spot on. In multi-billion dollar firms, it's very easy to launch a technology strategy and have a lot of internal full-time people. But I know in the lower middle market, people are very fearful of technology officers because it seems like they just continue to need more people and the CEO has no idea whether they actually are doing anything.
No, I think you're right. Yeah, if you look at studies around IT spend at the enterprise level, you know, consistently over the last 10, 15, 20 years, IT budgets consistently increase and grow and, you know, productivity enhances and, you know, stock market value goes up. So there's definitely a causal relationship there. But at the lower mid-market, it just doesn't seem to exist. That concept is kind of like, you know, passed them by or that they've never adopted that concept.
Talk about the companies that you buy. Are you typically partnering with entrepreneurs?
technology to the point where it is hurting their business, but they still struggle to come up with a solution for that. And when a private equity firm like ours comes in and says, hey, we'll do all the other things that a normal private equity firm will do, and in addition to that, we also have this, their eyes tend to light up and they can see how this is potentially the best partner for them.
So are there any top two, top one things that general entrepreneurial run companies are just missing that are quick fixes that, that you guys bring to the table? And obviously you have to be able to have the bench strength to execute on those.
The first one's a little more obvious. It's operational technologies that they see steps and processes and they've been doing it the same way for 5, 10, 15 years. They take orders from their customers the same way. They fulfill those orders the same way. They invoice, they pay. It seems like if it isn't broken, don't fix it. And that's been their mentality for many, many years. What they don't realize is that along the way, they've created an inefficiency. It seems efficient because they've done it the same way and it feels like clockwork to them. What they don't see is the alternative to that as it relates to digital, as it relates to integrated systems and how they're 20-person team that has this function could really be a 3-person team with a $500,000 technology solution. And if you take that cost savings over time, it would be tremendously valuable and, you know, take out the opportunity costs of not having that extra money that you could invest in another plant or another situation or retire debt. When you add the effect of technology over time as it relates to increasing and improving operational efficiencies, that seems to be a consistent missing link. And they look at all of those as we're doing it well enough. And it's partly because you don't know what you don't know. That would be like one thing. The other area that they're missing is a little bit more forward facing in that because these processes tend to be manual and tend to be paper intensive, they're not generating any data and they don't understand the data. They don't have data. They don't know how to manage it or analyze it. And that to me is a huge area of improvement. Once you get processes in place that are digital, you are now creating those streams. And once you have those data streams, if you know how to analyze those data streams, that's an area that can be a huge accelerator for firms of this size, how they interact with their customers, what they know about their customers, what they know about their buying patterns and behaviors, the geography of the customer is vital to the whole selling and marketing process. But if you ask most firms in this space, where are your customers? Where do they live? What are the 5 zip codes or the areas or the states that have the highest concentration of customers? They tend to not know any of those questions. They continue to, you know, create good product, sell it and distribute it in channels. But there's a whole nother element of business that they're missing that could be tremendously valuable and beneficial to them. But in order to have that, you need to start way in the back and digitize some of these things so that you actually have data that you control and you manage.
In order to do that, you have to be able to actually see all the things that you pointed out. And I think maybe we'll transition into the most favorite part of this podcast, I think, for me. You have a history and background of card counting in blackjack, shuffle tracking. So you must have almost like when Keanu Reeves achieved his matrix level where you could see the numbers going down the screen. You must have the ability to see things that others can't see. And that's obviously a huge value in the private equity world. Why don't you talk about your roots in that area of blackjack and the teams that you're involved in and how that led you into the private equity world?
So nowadays, I've since retired from playing blackjack professionally many years ago. However, I still teach a class on card counting, which some people have attended, and it frequently gets auctioned off at a charity event, and someone bids on it and then invites their friends. And I spend a few hours talking about blackjack, how it works, and why the game can be beat, as well as teaching people how to count cards. So a question I get asked often is, you know, how did I start down this journey? And it really was, I graduated from college in 92, and they had recently opened up a huge casino in Connecticut called Foxwoods. And somewhere along the way, I heard about card counting and blackjack and decided to go get a book, which I still have. It was a book written by Kenny Houston, and it's called Million Dollar Blackjack. And you read the book, you read the stories, and you see all the different math and the statistics and the numbers, and you think, okay, the concept makes sense, and now let's work on the execution. And so I spent hours and hours and hours counting cards to the point where I could you know, consistently count down a deck without any errors in, you know, low double-digit seconds, and count down 6 decks and 8 decks. And there are hundreds of different matrices that you have to memorize in terms of, you know, in this situation with, you know, dealer showing this and player showing this and the count being this and the rule set of the game being this, you know, what is the right play? And then try to become as robotic as possible and very disciplined. And you also have to manage money and bankroll, because no matter how good you are, you can go on streaks of consistently losing over and over again. And you have to have the bankroll sustain it, withstand it. And ultimately, what I learned now that I'm in the private equity world is there's a fascination in the private equity world with blackjack, which is why the events that I do on card counting are pretty well attended by some very successful people in PE, is that they're very transferable. And the concept of modeling in private equity is no different than the concept of modeling and knowing the numbers and having all the data. And then you have the same concept of managing a business with working capital, and the balance of your P&L and all that is no different than bankrolling in cards and in blackjack. And so they're very transferable skill sets, and it takes a ton of discipline. You can't be very emotional about your decision making, but you also realize that the numbers don't tell all the story. And in counting cards, there's an element of luck involved. You can make the right decision at the right time and then just be unlucky. Same goes for business. You can have the best product and the best marketing approach and the best operations and not be as successful. And so kind of marrying all those concepts together, I look at private equity through a lens that I looked through the blackjack world and was able to yield tremendous success at that. So I have high degrees of confidence in private equity that if you apply that and have the same rigor and discipline and execute properly, that we'll be successful on the private equity side.
Talk a little bit about your experience in that. And I'm curious, I always ask my guests to give advice to college students wanting to go into private equity investment banking. Is counting cards the one of the advices that you would give?
I would say, so my journey into private equity is definitely a little bit different than others. I'm coming as an entrepreneur, and, you know, the firm that I started 15 years ago, we've grown tremendously. We're a two-time member of the Crain's Fast 50, which in Chicago is the business magazine that measures growth of private firms. And so I've seen and managed the cycles. Yeah, I understand that the challenges that businesses have from an operating and a financial and an entrepreneurial standpoint. And so now I look and sit on the other side of the table and I judge other people's performances, which is interesting because the lens I look through is, I think, slightly less critical than private equity investors typically. Private equity investors look and they see a dip in revenue, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, or flatlining of growth, or a shrinking of profit margins. And they're very critical of entrepreneurs or founders and sellers. And I tend to look at that and say, you know, I get it. I get how you can't just grow every year. I understand how there will be years where your profit margin will shrink, and that's completely normal. It doesn't mean you have a bad business or your business is going out of business or it can't grow in the future. And so I would suggest to some 20-year-old that, you know, though it might be tempting to try to make that leap right into private equity because it's a great industry and, you know, people make a lot of money, and it's an area where you learn a lot about business because you get to meet with management teams and see their business and get information and get intimate about industries and businesses that you normally might not have that level of access to. But don't be afraid to go out and get into private equity after going through a pathway that is maybe more entrepreneurial, or you start something and you build it and you grow it, sell it to a private equity firm, and then maybe make the jump into private equity, because you definitely have a clearer, better perspective on what it takes to run and grow and operate a business. And even some of the operating partners that we use or we have seen, most of them were not entrepreneurs. They were executives at major companies that know an industry very well and had great careers and are very skilled at operating and all the elements of operating a business. And many of them were CEOs, but not many of them were entrepreneurs. And the entrepreneurial journey and the struggles, I think, gives you a different view than just the CEO journey. And so I would recommend to anyone, if you want to end up in private equity at some point, you may go through the path of being an entrepreneur and proving that you can do all the things that entrepreneurs do, growing a business, sell it to a private equity firm, and then make your jump that way.
Well, and I would bet with that kind of background that you have that you resonate well with the folks that you're talking to about buying their business.
Absolutely. Some of the challenges they speak to are challenges that I personally had to deal with, you know, whether they're HR challenges or customer concentration challenges and questions or working capital or long payment cycles, trying to integrate with your customers. Those are challenges that we face in our business, and I can sympathize with sellers, and I think they feel like it's quite genuine versus someone who's just been an investor and has seen those types of challenges over and over again, but didn't have to, you know, go to bed at night and think, if I don't solve this challenge, my future, my family, my business doesn't exist in 2 or 3 years.
So I was reading your bio earlier and saw that you're an avid golfer, a hockey player, and obviously it references the former professional blackjack player. So you've got to have a quote motto or something that drives you to be passionate about sports and blackjack.
Yeah, so I think, I don't know if it's a motto or if it's something, but this used to irk me a little bit. I would hear people say, you know, I hope for something a lot. And then, you know, I know there's a quote out there, a motto that says, hope is not a strategy. And that always lives with me. And whenever I hear people saying, I hope this happens or I hope this doesn't happen or I really wish this, I think, are you doing enough to actually help make something happen versus just hope something happens? And it's no different than someone at the blackjack table say, I hope I make money, or I hope this happens, or I hope I get a blackjack. And I'm like, there's so much more that I have done at the game of blackjack so that the hope element is minimized and the actual, you know, outcome, positive outcome is maximized. So that's always kind of resonated with me, as to don't let hope be your driving force, because hope is not a strategy.
Yeah, I love that one. And it's so funny how many people undermine themselves with the words that they speak, both verbally and just internally. And my favorite that I saw the other day on LinkedIn was the words that follow I am, follow you. And, you know, people are so often saying, I'm terrible at this, I'm not so good at that. And their brain starts to remind them and they become what they say. And so I love that. Hope is not a strategy. It's fantastic. So tipping back into the blackjack world, you shared with me before we started that you were on a blackjack team and there was a book written about your team. And can you expand on that a little bit? Because I think the listeners would love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So just continuing down the blackjack journey, you know, I picked up a book. I learned how to count cards, went to Connecticut, started playing with a good friend of mine, actually kind of my lifelong best friend. And we started making money playing blackjack. And then we heard that out in Vegas, they had single deck and double check games. And we thought, geez, if we can win money playing 8-deck games, how hard can a single and double deck game be? We went out to Vegas and we met another guy out there who also was a founding member of the team. And he's an ex-Goldman guy, funny enough, and he had turned to blackjack professionally and was doing it full time. So we started traveling around the country, the three of us, just meeting up because, you know, it can be a little bit lonely just trying to play blackjack on your own. Then he met a brother-sister team on a trip, and they both were, you know, top-tier lawyers at big firms. They were in the New York area where we were as well. And so we got together and started playing. We went to Atlantic City together and spent a few months down there and did very well as a team. I don't know if you know how blackjack works or how the numbers work in blackjack, but most people don't know that the only advantage that the house has in blackjack is that if you break, so you go over 21, and they break in the same cycle, they go over 21, that is a win for the house. So other hands, if I get 17 and you get 17, is a push. If you get 20, I get 20, it's a push. But if the player breaks and the house breaks, it is not a push. The house takes that money. And that happens 6.24% of the time, break, break. Every other rule in blackjack is actually designed to favor the player if the player takes advantage of that rule properly. So for example, we get to double down if we like our cards relative to the house's cards. The dealer cannot make us double down in the reverse situation. Splitting and blackjack pays 3-2, and all of these other rules, insurance, surrender, are designed to help the player recoup and claw back from that starting structural deficit of 6.4%. You have to just know when to use it. And so the art of counting cards is, as cards come out, and blackjack is also one of the few games where the odds are dynamic versus static. You know, obviously rolling a 7 in craps is the same whether I've rolled 5 sevens or not. But if all of the aces are out of a 6-deck shoe, there are no aces left to come out until there's a shuffle. So the odds change as each card is played. So counting cards is the art of observing the cards as they come out and then whatever remains to be played effectively changes the way the game should be played and the odds of certain occurrences. And when the remaining cards are favorable to the player, the other option we get to do that the house doesn't is we get to choose how much we bet. And so when the remaining cards are positive to us, we bet more than when they are not. And thus that creates a huge advantage for us in terms of taking advantage of situations that are in our favor. So counting cards is identifying when those situations are, betting is kind of the leverage, and then all the variations on play are where all these other charts come in and all the numbers and statistics come in. But effectively, that's kind of how blackjack works. The part that's more challenging is it's pretty simple if you're a professional card counter to know when other people are counting cards, because if I'm counting cards, I know what the count is. I know when I should be increasing my bets. And if I would observe a player next to me who's increasing their bets correlated to the count at a high enough frequency, I would know they were counting cards. So if I can do that, imagine a multi-billion dollar industry who designed a game and plays it in their house under hundreds of cameras, that's not hard for them to do. So an individual card counter gets kicked out of casinos frequently because they have to vary their bet in order to get leverage. But at the same time, casinos look for that, which is why, I don't know if you've observed, but you know, when you bet more money at a casino, they yell out checks play, signaling that you are betting a large amount of money so that the pit or the camera can look and say, okay, let me monitor this person. What we did on our team was we play in 5-person teams. So if you can imagine, you have 4 counters. Those are people who are trained to go ahead and determine, you know, when the count is they're basically counting cards and they're determining when the count is in our favor. And then you pair that with a person whose job is to just bet money. But the way the structure works is the counters are in, say, one pit, but at different tables. And the bettor is kind of lurking in the area of that general pit, waiting for a signal to come in and bet. And as the count gets good, they get signaled in. The bettor then bets a large amount of money, but they've never seen any cards. So the casino can't correlate as easily the count to the bet because in their view, this person is coming in middle of a shoe. They couldn't have counted cards. So thus that bet cannot be correlated to a count. And so you imagine that play goes down. The casino then has to figure out, is this a team? Who's on the team? Who's signaling what? All of our signals were verbal, or most of them were verbal because there's no audio in casino recordings. And so that's the fundamental structure of a team that's different than an individual. And so we started this team, and this team went on to have a pretty illustrious run over about a decade. And I think we were the largest professional team in the world, though I don't know if there's any real statistic on it. But there's a book written about us called Johnny Magic and the Card Shark Kids. One of the team members, kind of in the middle of our run, was a guy named John Finkel. He was the reigning world champion of card game Magic the Gathering, and he was learning to be a professional blackjack player as well as a professional poker player while being the reigning world champion of Magic. And an author, David Kushner, followed him around, chronicled this, turned it into a book, and the rest is history. Though I unfortunately don't get any royalties or anything from the books, which makes me a little sad, but I've gotten over it. Yeah.
So what ended the run of the team?
So I think like many things in life, you know, all good things come to an end. It's just, you know, playing blackjack is like any other job. And it takes a tremendous amount of focus and mental energies to count cards for that long. And at some point, you just kind of cycle out of it. And add to that, you know, other parts of my career being more demanding. For me, it just kind of naturally just cycled out and ended. Others played for a little bit longer. But one of the major factors really was the casinos got better at identifying counters, and they also made structural changes to the game of blackjack so that it was more and more difficult to make high returns. So we were making about 3-3.5% on every dollar bet. And if you tweak the rules a little bit, so for example, now they've introduced your 6-5 blackjack as a payout versus 3-2. That change alone makes the game of blackjack unprofitable for even a professional. And so you imagine they tweak some rules here and there. They get a little bit better at identifying card counters and counting teams. So you have one element of your career becoming more demanding and more lucrative, and you have the time you spend playing blackjack becoming less lucrative. And at some point you decide that you're not going to spend any more time over there.
So do you still go to casinos at all, or Las Vegas, or is that a pastime for you?
I can't say I really enjoy it. If anything, I have more pleasure having others play blackjack, me counting and just instructing them as to what to do, than actually playing my own money.
It's fascinating, and I think probably most of our listeners have either read one of the books or seen the movie. The movie is either 21 or Bringing Down the House. I can't remember which.
So the book is Bringing Down the House, and it's written about the MIT blackjack team, which we played a lot with those guys. If you play professional blackjack, you tended to be on one of the two or three professional teams out there, and each had slightly different criteria for certifying. But we had many members of our team who were certified on the MIT team and vice versa. Interestingly, they had two different teams typically in play at any one time. And then the movie 21 was written about their blackjack team. But the movie is not very good relative to the book. I think the kind of commercialized play a little bit. It's not technically precise. So when I watch the movie, I look at things within the movie. I'm like, they would never do that. You know, there's a scene where, you know, the entire team is playing on one table. And as I described, you would never do that. You would never have multiple team members on one table, because your leverage is having each counter at a different table, because the chance that one shoe is bettable, you know, the count is high enough that you can bet on it, is not very high. And so you need to cover as many shoes as possible. So you'd never have your entire team on one table. That just doesn't happen. But in the movie, there is a scene where they're all at one table, and I'm like, that would never happen.
What about getting beat up in the hallway in the bottom of the casino?
Yeah, you know what? At the end of the day, there is no law against counting cards. So there's no law against counting cards. But because it's a private business, they can ask you, you know, it's no different than walking into a restaurant without shoes on. Listen, I'm going to put on your shoes. And if you refuse to put on your shoes, they can ask you to leave. And if you refuse to leave, then they call the police and say you're trespassing. So that's effectively what happened in blackjack, is they would ask you not to play. But most of the time, they tend to be quite polite. And I think part of it is no one wants to make a scene. They don't want a whole casino full of people and see some fight break out. So they have a reputation to protect. But part of me also says they're not 100% sure they're right when they make their decision to ask you not to play the game. And so if they're wrong, then they want to leave open the chance that if you are not a professional and you're betting a lot of money. So, for example, you know, many times I played the role of the bettor in that 5-person pod. And what I found was that they believe I may be part of a team, and thus they ask me not to play. But what if they're wrong? They want to err on the side of caution, because if I'm just a person betting lots of money without knowing what the count is, and they kick me out, that's a huge source of income that they're basically just terminating. So a lot of times they would just ask me, hey, we have a great steak restaurant and we made reservations for you at 8:00. And that would be how they would signal to me that they wanted me to no longer play the game of blackjack.
I can tell why having that type of experience and background would make you a really good investor and partner for businesses. It seems like that would be a skill set that not many people have in any industry, let alone private equity.
I've told this story, and the story also resonates. Some similar to kind of the investment thesis around technology resonates. The whole blackjack story resonates. Once you hear it and understand that it's not just, you know, just trying to roll the dice and get lucky, when it's very tactical, it's very strategic, there's a tremendous amount of work and effort and diligence that goes into being good at it, as well as being able to execute it at a casino at the level that we did. You're right. I think sellers think and look through the lens of, now what if we could have this person as a partner and this firm as a partner, applying some of those same skills and disciplines and techniques to helping our business grow and develop. And they view that quite positively and constructively once they start to hear more of the nuances around why being a professional blackjack player or counter of cards works and is effective.
So since you're so strong in the technology side of things, I'm curious, what do you see coming down the pipe in the next 5 or 10 years is probably too long, but in the near term that are really important for businesses to be paying attention to from a technology perspective?
Even 5 years is probably too long. Maybe if you're hanging out in Silicon Valley all the time, you have a look into 5 years. But even then, 5 years out, it's really hard to predict what technologies will be adopted and will stick, will have stickiness. You just look back and you say that smartphones are 12 years old. The Apple iPhone was released 12 years ago. And look at the huge change in everything around how we operate a business as well as how we interact socially has happened. But looking out just 1, 2, or 3 years, the whole quest for data and understanding and yielding analytics and advantage around data needs to make its way down into the mid-market, lower mid-market, or else they're just going to get outplayed by bigger firms. You always have the effect of Amazon. And really, it's not only is Amazon just this huge dominant player, but they're just so much better at keeping pace and being on the front end of all these technology trends that if your business at all could be a business that Amazon might want to capture, you need to be very focused on trying to keep pace with some level of technology to avoid just being overwhelmed. And a lot of the technology I think is going to come out in the next 1 to 3 years is going to be around different ways to automate functions, whether it's autonomous vehicle and moving goods and services around, or something as simple as, you know, using computer vision and visualization to identify certain situations in certain environments. So we don't want to pay somebody to stand on a platform and look down at a shop floor and monitor everything that's going on. It's just very expensive. But a set of cameras looking down with the software behind it to recognize certain patterns is not going to be very expensive. And so if you take something like that concept and apply it into a whole bunch of different use cases, you can see where companies decide that we need to be looking at that or thinking about that. And if they don't, it doesn't necessarily mean they'll go out of business. But if they were to, think of the competitive advantage they can have over their peer groups in the spaces that they cover. That's kind of what I see in the next 1 to 3 years.
So, David, thank you so much for your time today. It was really a great podcast. I think the audience is going to enjoy it. And hopefully we can have you speak at some of our North Star events to a live audience at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to, Jeff. And thanks again for having me on.
Thank you for listening to North Star's Private Equity Fast Pitch. For more information about North Star and the Private Equity Fast Pitch or their boutique heavy hitter events, you can visit us at enorthstar.com.